From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys for this week. Kind of come full circle. 2 weeks back, we had Hunter and John and myself missing. Last week, we had Hunter and myself with John missing. And this week, we've got John and myself with Hunter missing. So, yeah, we've tackled all three combinations there. So, hopefully, with any luck, we'll have Hunter back next week. As I said, he's not here this week. But I do have John. How you going, brother?
Pretty good.
That is good. How's the cat?
He's good. I had to bring him down downstairs because he's causing too much of a ruckus upstairs. We have a house full of animals, so it's like Serpico's apartment, as I always describe it.
Serpico's apartment, well, like Dr. Doolittle's.
Yeah, well, if you watch apparently they're like if you watch the Pacino movie, they kind of imply that he keeps animals in his apartment, but. Like the real Serpico, his apartment was like loaded with them.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a zoo. I mean, I also think Frank Serpico might have been mentally ill too. You know, I'm sure our police officer listeners don't like hearing that, but I've seen some stuff to confirm that.
Have you ever read the book Serpico ever?
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, I've got it. I picked it up at a thrift store for like a buck, I think.
Same here. I think I paid like 50 cents for it at a thrift store.
Yeah.
It was like a hardcover edition, first printing. And, you know, it's, I don't know. I often wondered if maybe he was just one of the cops that got caught and he was a great, you know, turncoat source. You know, I mean, it had to be done, but, you know, I watched the A&E biography. He seemed like a pretty annoying person. Mm-hmm. And I was like, even like he was getting into those disguises like a hammy actor. You know, like he's dressed up like Arab Sheik in one photo. And he's doing it. And I'm like, man, maybe they shot him for being annoying. You know, it's just like, oh, God, here comes Serpico in his costumes.
That is a very, very good book. Good movie as well.
Yeah, it is a good book. The movie's excellent. It's a good book. It is a great movie. It's something else.
It's a far more faithful adaptation than the complete mess that is Midnight Express. I've got that book as well by William Hayes.
Yeah,
the original one, and the movie strays so far from the original book by Hayes that it's not even. It's a Oliver Stone cocaine binge, you know, written piece of
right.
shit. I hate the fucking
Oliver
movie.
Stone fantasy world.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I first liked the movie. First time I saw it, but I'd not read the book. I picked up the book in the like 1990-91 and read that and. Yeah, this is nothing like the movie. Watch the movie again. I thought this is shit. It's just complete shit. You know, John Hurt looking like some fucking spaced out hippie, and
I haven't seen it in years. I remember when it was a big hit in theaters, and you know, dumped on cable and stuff, and being a big deal. But I think I saw it once when I was young, and that was it. Like I just remember it as a movie that got Paul Smith out of the rut of being a Bud Spencer clone.
Really?
Oh, yeah. To this day, I still have people thinking Bud Spencer played Bluto in the Popeye movie, the Altman Popeye. And I said, no, that was Paul Smith. Paul Smith started his career as a Bud Spencer clone because he looked just like him.
It is very, very true.
Yeah.
It's very true.
And even in Pieces, that Spanish giallo, Paul Smith's in the movie and he gets into a fight with some cops that are arresting him because he's a red herring. And there's Bud Spencer sound effects when he's fighting the cops.
Oh, my goodness.
It's choreographed like a Bud Spencer fight. Then I see him on the last season of Hawaii 5-0, and he's in the season premiere as a union leader, and he gets into a fight with some cops who are arresting him. It's the same thing as like a Bud Spencer fight on Hawaii 5-0.
Jesus. Hey, who had the biggest solo career out of the two? Was it Hill or Spencer?
I would say Terrence Hill. Bud Spencer had like various careers. He was not just an actor. He was like a wrestler in the Olympics, like in the 40s. And he was also like a politician. He was an inventor. He like had a bunch of patents registered of stuff he had invented. He's a helicopter pilot. He's like a, you know, he was a real, what do you call him? I forget what the word is.
Renaissance man?
Yeah, I guess that's the best way to put it. Yeah. Like, really, just very good. Like a polymath, I think, is the other phrase. Like,
okay.
Really good at different things. Yeah, Terrence Hill's just kind of been an actor, a really busy one. Yeah, I think his show on Italian TV, Don Matteo, which plays on some MHZ channels in the States, that's run for like 10 years or something, maybe even more.
Wow.
And he lives in the U.S. He just flies to Italy to do movies and TV, and then he comes back to the U.S. to live.
Okay. Well, yeah, contrary to popular belief, we're not actually covering Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer again this week. We're just riffing. We are going to be covering a couple of episodes of The Twilight Zone, but we'll get to that shortly. John, made any purchases or seen anything this week?
I saw The Nice Guys. I went to a preview screening of Shane Black's new movie opening this summer with Ryan Gosling and your favorite Russell Crowe. And I was really impressed. Warner Brothers reps were actually at this screening. They were telling us that if we worked for the media, we couldn't write a review. Like, we can't review.
So how'd you get in with this, the MMC clout, was it? You know, it's like,
no, I wish. The Alamo Drafthouse had a special where it was like, buy a food voucher, see the movie for free, and, you know.
Shit, that's not bad.
Watch a Q&A screening after the screening. I mean, it's a test screening, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I wasn't going to go because it's my wife's social night, and the night I stay home and babysit the kid, you know.
Yeah.
And then my friend had bought seats for it, and he was like, you want to go? I was like, I got an extra food voucher. I was like, sure. So I was like, I had my wife switch her social night, and I went and really enjoyed it. Like, it was the movie I was looking forward to this summer. I don't care anything about Civil War or anything else, but I was really looking forward to this because it's a 70s detective comedy thriller.
Really?
And okay. I was really impressed. It was like, it's like an Abbott and Costello. You could actually call it Abbott and Costello and the porno murder mystery, because it's basically what it is. It's like an Abbott and Costello movie with graphic violence and nudity and all, like a 70s detective film. It's really, really fun. I'm looking forward to paying to see it again. Like, I'll go see it in the theater again.
Jeez. Is it along the lines of, say, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Yes, I mean, it's probably closer to, well, yeah, I mean, it's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but I think it's actually better. It's okay. Almost like he took elements of that. You could spot elements from Lethal Weapon. He wrote the original Lethal Weapon screenplay.
Yeah.
You could see those different elements in there, but it's like, it's almost like he perfected them. Like, this is like the perfect version of that stuff. It's like if Kiss Kiss Bang Bang were actually a real detective movie set in the 70s or with that style, but a leaner, better, you know, tighter screenplay.
And it's but it's not as good as Iron Man 3, right?
Oh, yes. You know, that was a masterpiece. It was two of Marvel movies. Good Lord. It makes up for the drudgery that was Iron Man 3.
The masterpiece of shit.
Oh, God. Terrible film. Iron Man 3, last new release movie I saw in 35mm. What a sad way to say goodbye to that format.
Well, really? Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Rodriguez will be back with the 35. No, he's digital, doesn't he? He's all digital now these days.
He's all digital. He doesn't do 35mm.
That's right, yeah.
Christopher Nolan does.
That's right, yeah.
He's like the only director with a clout to get away with it. It's interesting, but I've been attending that James Ellroy series at the Alamo, and he hosted Skyfall a few months ago, and they got a 35mm print of Skyfall.
Oh.
And you could tell the difference in the sound. Like, it was loud as hell.
Really?
You really could. It's kind of like, all right, they always said CDs could never capture the bass of vinyl, and vinyl has superior bass.
That is true.
And I think that's how it is with 35mm and digital prints.
Okay.
I think it's something about the bass. Like, sound was amazing. Like, it was just incredible. Because it's not digital sound, technically.
Because these days, projectionists aren't really projectionists. They just button pushes, that's it.
Exactly, because everybody uses digital prints. And I've yet to see anything bad on a digital print, but they don't have to do anything now. You don't need a projectionist union, probably.
Well, when I saw Annabelle a couple of years back in the theater, there was button pusher must have run late in the toilet or something like that, or I don't know what, but at the specified time of the screening, there was nothing on the screen and nothing on the screen. And then all of a sudden, the screen pops up real quick with a play button on it. And I'm like, okay. He's a button pusher. And he hits C, play pushed. And then the trailer for Let's Be Cops, unfortunately, comes up. And then the movie, I'm like, there's no art to this shit. This is just all, it's all stored on a fucking, like a, you know, 2-3 terabyte file, hard drive, you know, double click and that's it. And just walk away, basically. Just walk away. That's all they do.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's
all they have to do. And you would think it would lower the ticket price because it's a hell of a lot cheaper to mail those to theaters.
Oh, God, yeah.
35 millimeter. If you've ever carried a 35 millimeter print, it is a pain in the ass because I did it for Garrow a couple of times.
Yeah.
Man, I'd rather mow 5 lawns than carry a 35 millimeter print.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just so much easier. And this shit's all beamed in these days. It's like, just this crazy. But I mean, you don't even get no more the. You know when you used to watch a film with a 35mm print? Used to be that flicker, like the 24 frames per second flicker? You don't get that no more with digital files.
No. This is what's weird. I went to see the Alien and Aliens double feature last week at the Alamo. Yeah. They had new digital prints from Fox. I swear, on scenes that were shot on videotape for some of the, you know, just to put into the film, like they were looking at the video monitors,
it looks
like video on the digital print. Like it wasn't filmed in 35 minutes. It was creepy because it's like, and I think it's the frame rate that makes it look that way. But it really, like, I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me. It's like, no, it's not it wasn't originally shot on video. So why does it look like that? So it's kind of freaking me out.
Yeah, but I mean, I can get a more authentic feel of a digital film of a 35mm film in my projector upstairs because it actually got a function on there. Called film projection.
Mm-hmm.
You can have it on or off. I have it on usually for films because what it does, it emulates that flicker of a film. It really feels like you're watching a 35mm print, even though you're watching a Blu-ray disc.
Right.
So, I mean, they haven't even got that built into the projectors over there. That, I mean, I've got it on my one. So, just crazy it is.
Yeah, but, Blu-ray is odd that way because everything's grainy, like on old movies. If anything's dark, there tends to be a bit of grain.
Well,
they've never really controlled that with DNR or anything.
No, I mean, it's very rare that a good one gets through where it's completely eliminated all the grain, like Taxi Driver's one, where it just looks unbelievable for a film of 40 years old, you know?
To Catch a Thief is another one that I thought looked perfect. Like, I couldn't see any grain.
Yeah, yeah. Even A Hard Day's Night, which is in black and white, looked pretty flawless to these eyes. But, anyway, I picked up a few purchases this week. JB Hi-Fi's got a sale on.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up the Hammer film, Curse of the Werewolf, on Blu-ray for $7.
Mm-hmm.
You ever seen that, John?
Yes.
Oliver Reed?
Yeah. That might have been the first werewolf movie I ever watched.
I had never seen it before. I wanted to, but I thought for $7. Of course, now, a day after I buy them, they stick them on 20% off, so it comes down to like $5.50, but whatever. I didn't lose that much. But I popped some out on. It looks really, really good. I got to say, are you familiar with that woman, Yvonne Romaine?
Was she like the starlet, one of the Hammer starlets?
She was, in this film, she was the female servant who gives birth to...
Okay, I remember.
Oh, man.
Well, they always picked the hot women because they couldn't really afford great sets. They just put what they could into what they had. And
they
knew hot girls were going to get you to watch those movies.
They hit a home run with that one. My goodness. I never knew of it, but I went, holy shit, who's that?
So, yeah. Well, I did pick up one Blu-ray last week.
Okay.
Purchase Shadows in an Empty Room. It's like a 70s... Euro crime movie filmed in Canada. It was like a Canadian tax shelter production, like co-production with Italy. And it has a cast that's like Stuart Whitman, Martin Landau, Tisa Farrow, John Saxon. It's like, I'd never seen it. I just pre-ordered it on like just a, you know, it had been recommended. Because I guess it used to play on videotape as Blazing Magnum, which is a more accurate title.
Right.
And so when they release it over here, they call it Shadows in an Empty Room, selling it like it's a horror film, which it's not. It's this insane Italian-Canadian Dirty Harry knockoff with Stuart Whitman as like this invincible middle-aged cop that I swear he spends half the movie fighting thugs and bad guys, and there's this great, you know, Italian soundtrack music playing throughout the entire film. Like, he has his own theme music when he's beating people up, and he's like in his 50s and he's invincible as Bruce Lee, you know.
Was the soundtrack by Goblin at all?
It sounds like something Goblin might do for a cop film. And it was so super enjoyable. There's this incredible scene where he's fighting these drag queens, and they're all doing kung fu and stuff, and he's knocking the hell out of them, and they're playing this action music. And it's actually got a pretty decent mystery to it. And also, Gail Honeycutt's in it from Shadow Man. Like, she has a small film, and it's really, I was surprised. It's really good. It's a fun, the plot kind of ties together. It has a great car chase, almost as good as the one in 7-Ups. Apparently they were just allowed to tear up the Canadian city they were filming in and just like did whatever they wanted to do. But it's a really good chase scene. It's highly recommended. Okay. I can't recommend it enough.
Who put that out? Who was it?
I think it was Kino. Because it's an MGM license. And you could find it. I mean, it's on Amazon. It's under the title Shadows in an Empty Room. It's on Blu-ray. It's only like $15. You can also rent it from Amazon streaming for like, I think like $3 or something. But no, it's a great flick.
Nice.
It's really cool. Really. I mean, if you're into this sort of thing, some people have problems with the lack of what we would call reality or real life in these Italian cop films. You might have issues with it, but I don't. Like, I just thought it was a blast.
Nice. Nice. Well, I also picked up Brides of Dracula, the other Hammer film.
I love that one. That's my favorite Hammer vampire movie.
Okay, I have not seen it. I popped in to just check it out, and looks sweet. Yeah, it looks really rich in color, so I'm looking forward to seeing that over, Monday or Tuesday on my days off work. And also picked up Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight.
My gosh.
I like that one. Bordello of Blood. Oh, God, that's not good. Even though Angie Everhart's a absolute fucking babe up, but Bordello of Blood. And tomorrow when I head out to do a couple of things, while the 20% off sale's on, I'm going to pick up the original Bob Clark Black Christmas for $5.50 from JB. I've not seen that since forever.
I haven't seen it since 1986. Probably
about the same time I think I saw it, mid-80s. Yeah.
I remember it well. That's actually John Saxon's favorite role in his entire career.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Mm. It's strange what actors dig, but I guess he had a good time making the film and like respected the role or something. But that was his favorite, all-time favorite role.
Did you ever see the remake of Black Christmas?
No.
Don't.
It's never got around to seeing it. Stupid. I didn't see the point. These days, when they try to do this stuff, they don't get it. They just don't. They don't get what made the original so good or memorable, and they just don't understand anything.
Well, I watched it because it was made by the original guys, by the guys who did the remake of Willard, which I thought was a decent movie. The remake of Willard.
I heard that was pretty good.
It actually is very, very good. Because Crispin Glover helps a lot. That he's just batshit nuts, and
Chris, it's an automatic cult movie because he's starring in it.
Exactly. But that was actually a decent movie, even though I've got a massive fear of rodents and mice and
I don't like them much.
No, I don't. That's why that scene in The Abominable Dr. Fibes, I think of the first one, where that guy's getting eaten by the rats, and you see one shot of a rat like with a piece of the guy's sinew in his mouth just chewing on it, like, oh, this is gross. really graphic.
I haven't seen those Dr. Fibes movies. Those are others I haven't seen in like 30 years, but I probably need to check them out eventually.
They are fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. But, so that's my pitch. Oh, and I've also got, House of Wax 3D coming on Blu-ray to my house on the way, because it's always been... Since it was released in October 2013, it's always been a cost prohibitive and a very high price of mid-30s, late-30s in the American dollar. Then, of course, the freight. I'm looking at just stupid amount of dollars, but it eventually dropped to $20. I'm like, okay, I'm snapping now. I'm biting on this one. Mm-hmm. But, it was temporarily out of stock for days and days. I had to literally get onto Amazon's back via their chat saying, when's this getting shipped? When's it getting shipped?
And have you checked it out for the quality?
Oh, yeah.
Looks good.
I read the review as soon as it was poster back in October 2013, and they said he's unbelievable. And yeah, so
yeah, I've got an old Snapcase DVD of that one.
Yeah, so do I. And it comes with all the features from that as well. You know, the original Mystery of the Wax Museum's on there, only in standard def. But I mean, hey, you know, it's a cool little film.
It's a, yeah.
I enjoy it. Not as good as House of Wax, but still very, very enjoyable.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that's on the way. That's finally on the way. Yeah, that, you know, still listed as temporarily out of stock on the site, but for some reason they shipped one to me because I was just being such a pain in the ass, saying, come on, enough. So, yeah.
They didn't want their name to be Mud in Melbourne. They were like, this guy's a loudmouth. Let's make him happy.
Just get it out. Just find one, get it out, and just shut him up. That's it. But,
yeah.
All right. So, anyway, that's enough of us rambling. So now we're going to get into the Twilight Zone episodes. We decided to pick one each and just give like a primer on this fantastic show that you guys should know about. If you don't, because you're a youngin', well, okay, you've been forgiven, but get moving because this show is amazing. And, yeah.
My kid's 6 years old and is hooked on the show, so they have no excuse.
Does he have a problem following the story and obviously the twists that come with it at the end for most of them?
I think he does with some of them. I've only shown him select ones. It's usually best to pick out ones that have robots and aliens and monsters because, you know, he's not really going to get the psychological Twilight Zones at all. One of the ones we're reviewing tonight, I showed to him. He didn't really get it. I think even when he doesn't understand the story, he likes the atmospherics and stuff. And it was funny how he wanted to watch it. He watches this cartoon called Peg Plus Cat, which like teaches kids math. And I guess they did this reference to the Twilight Zone and spoofed a Twilight Zone in one episode or one of the Peg Plus Cat movies. And then he was asking me about it. And I said, oh, it's this anthology show.
Yeah.
It was on TV years ago. It's in black and white. And he was obsessed with watching it. So I showed him Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, and he has watched it because kids love repetition. He has probably watched it about 8 or 9 times, including about 7 times before he got on an airplane to fly to San Diego. So he was obsessed with it. He just loved it.
It's here, son, you can have the window seat.
Right. Yeah, he was just constantly asking me logic questions about the motivations of William Shatner's character. And
everybody questions the motivations of William Shatner alone.
Right. Like, he's asking me about all the, you know, just every detail about the episode. And then I showed him the Saturday Night Live spoof. It's actually pretty well done with Jude Law, where he's looking at he's seeing the gremlin on the plane wing and like the gremlin's like cooking food. And and then hanging out with Pearl Jam, you know, it's like
they should have had the gremlin on the wing with who's that Diners, Drive-ins, and Dives guy? Oh, Guy Fieri,
yeah, or something like that. I mean, I'm sure they could get Guy Fieri on there that night. It would have happened, but if he was just doing all these things, like he's trying to put a big birthday or a big wedding cake on from one table to the next and try not to spill it. It's just like. It's a really well done sketch. I'm sure it aired during the writer's hour of Saturday Night Live, you know, after the news. Experimental shit, you know.
Did you ever show him the George Miller 20,000 Feet
one? No, he asked me about that movie, and I said, because I started watching the show again with him, yeah. Because I hadn't looked at it in years. I wasn't a huge fan of it when I was a kid, because it's like you watch it on syndicated TV and. And, you know, unless it's got a lot of really visual stuff, you're not really going to be into it.
Mm.
And I just hadn't watched it in years, and he wanted to watch it. I said, okay, we'll sit down and watch a few episodes. I kind of got hooked on watching it again and realized that, okay, this is what I missed out on, you know, not having this easy access to the show and being able to cherry pick the episodes I watch. And so we watched stuff like The Howling Man. And
That's fantastic.
Yeah, which was a pretty memorable episode, even though I think the devil costume at the end is pretty silly, but it's still the acting's fun.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, we watched that one and pretty much anything with a creature or monster. Eye of the Beholder, we watched a couple of times. I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, that's wow. Did that freak him the hell out? Because that's
No, because kids don't see that stuff as scary, you know? It's just like, oh, I'm just looking at another world. They don't see it from that context that it's supposed to be frightening. Yeah. I don't think he quite got the contradiction of it. I had to kind of explain it to him.
What about To Serve Man? Have you shown him that one yet?
Wait, I think, yeah, we did. He didn't really quite get the spoof element there or the joke on that one. We also did the Monsters, or what's it called? The Monsters Are on Maple Street,
Monsters
or whatever.
Due on Maple Street, yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah, and he had trouble comprehending that one, but for me it was kind of fun to watch these and realize that pretty well done. The one he really liked was the Steel episode with Lee Marvin, the boxer.
Sure.
It's like,
yeah,
he liked that one. It was like, it's funny, the ones he really dug, and he liked some of the funny ones too.
It's not as good as Real Steel with Hugh Jackman, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Hardly anybody knows that was based on that
the same short story.
Richard Matheson, right, wrote that one.
Right, yeah, he wrote the short story, and it spawned that movie and the Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, sure,
but you know, the Charles Beaumont. I'm realizing the Charles Beaumont episodes always have that kind of extra sheen to them that they come off really well. I read a book of Charles Beaumont short stories, including the original Howling Man story, and it was pretty impressive stuff. I think those books are still available. You could get some decently priced collections of Beaumont's writing.
Yeah, you should show him that one. I think it's called The Prime Mover. Have you seen that one?
Which one is that?
That's the one about that guy who's the gambler Franklin. And he's obsessed with the, wrong one. No, what's the one I'm thinking of? That's not The Prime Mover. That's, it'll come to me. It's the one with that machine's going, Franklin, Franklin.
I know there's one with the uncle. What was it? They use the Robbie the Robot suit, but it's like the mean uncle and the bitchy, like the kind of bitchy niece that just wants his inheritance.
Yeah.
And he dies, and then I think it's got a title like Uncle Charlie or something like that.
Oh.
And he leaves her a robot that she's got to serve, the robot who's just as abusively annoying as the uncle was.
Really, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great later one. It's actually one of the better later ones.
I think the one I'm talking about, The Fever, I believe it's called.
The Fever.
Yeah. Okay,
haven't watched that one yet. I even let him watch the one with the talking doll. Talking Tina.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask, did he see the Talkie Tina one?
Yeah, he enjoyed that one.
Oh, shit.
I had to watch it before I showed it to him. It was like, I don't know, I might scare him, you know? It's just like, and I let him watch it.
Yeah, some of those. I mean, they're tame for, you know, obviously being through the late 50s and 60s, but some can still be pretty freaking scary.
Yeah, it's like I have no idea what's going to disturb him, because you can't tell with a kid. It's like, there's stuff I watched with a kid, didn't do anything for me. Didn't bother me until I might watch it as an adult and go, ugh, you know, that was worse than I remembered.
Have you ever seen that show, Bookaboo?
No.
Getting on the kids' shows? No, you never seen it.
It's a really no, odd, not familiar with it.
It's an odd show. It's British, and it's about a dog called Bookaboo who's a drummer. It's a puppet, so it's a puppet dog.
Right.
And he's a drummer in a rock band, and he has a special guest on every week with him, because his thing is his catchphrase is a story a day or I just can't play. So it's basically like, you know, rock stars are drug addicts and can't go on stage without drugs. Well, his is he has to have a book read to him so he can go on stage to play drums. Mm-hmm. So it's like a show trying to teach kids how to read books, you know, to get interested in books. But the strange thing is, John, that they've actually modeled the look of the dog Bookaboo on John Bonham from Led Zeppelin.
What?
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
I don't think this show airs in the US anywhere.
Okay, yeah, it's just...
I have never heard of it. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, we got a market glutted with kids shows. I mean, we got tons of them.
Yeah, we got on the CBeebies channel, which is the British channel. And, yeah, I'm like, I'm sitting there going, what is the go with this dog? It's like, I looked it up, drummer. Okay, I looked up a picture of John Bonham. It's like, holy shit, they've actually modeled him on John Bonham. Bizarre, man. Really bizarre.
I would have never imagined that.
Yeah, it's crazy. But all right, look, let's get into these two episodes that we were going to be talking about tonight. The first one is from season 2, episode 20, episode called Static, one you picked. Yeah. Okay, what made you pick this one, John?
It's unusual. Nobody ever talks about it. Everybody always talks about the standard ones that we've just mentioned. I had never seen it. I didn't realize some episodes were shot on videotape. I think they were actually avoided in the old TV syndication packages because they probably looked pretty bad.
I was just going to say, I think there was either 8 to 10 episodes shot on video. There was one where Billy Mumy made, I think it was in Praise of Pip, I think was...
Where the dead grandma was calling him?
Yeah, yeah. I think that was shot on video.
We watched that. That was shot on video. We watched that a few weeks ago.
And then I was watching this one today. This was the first one I watched out of the two. I'm like, oh, this is one of the ones shot on video. This is really early because this is season two. I thought they'd actually done the video ones later and around 63, you know, around the fourth or fifth season. But yeah, and there is a bonus on this episode with an interview with Buzz Kulick by the author of the fantastic Twilight Zone companion book, Mark Zakri. And he was talking to him. I only heard a couple of minutes. He was actually saying how this one was shot on video and things like that. So, yeah, this was, yeah, you're right. This was shot on video. Yeah. As opposed to the majority of them being shot on film.
Right, right. And I thought it was fascinating because I was thinking, well, you know, it might have been slightly better if it was shot on film. Because then they would, because some of the takes are a little, it's like there, it would be a retake if they were shot on film. Yeah. Does it, because it's, you know, that kind of live TV feel or video or however they did it. I thought Dean Jagger, it's, I usually have always seen Dean Jagger as the scary old man in movies. You know, he's always the old corporation guy or whatever who's evil, or Game of Death, he's the crime boss killing the fake.
I know, right? I know.
Right, right. And I'd never seen him as a more youthful middle-aged actor at this point and playing this type of role where he had to be like a, you know, a human being. And, it, you know, it was a trip to watch. I'm a big fan of old-time radio. And it fascinates me that, and this is something I first noticed, and apologies if I brought it up on the show before, but I don't know if everybody listens to every episode. I listened to a Long John Neville. He was this all-night radio host in the 1960s. So a lot of his shows are on YouTube. Well, I was listening to him interview, I think it was Jim Harmon, who was like an old-time radio nostalgia guy. In the 1960s, they were calling radio that was just from 15 years before old-time radio. They were already calling it that in the 60s.
Wow.
Yes, which stunned me. And then I watched this episode. They still kind of treat it like it's old-time radio, and it was only 15. I mean, in this case, it was like 20 years. Tommy Dorsey is supposed to be like 20 years before or whatever. Yeah. But it's still calling it old-time radio like it's nostalgia. And it's like, was technology moving so fast and TV got so popular, radio was getting blipped out. It was amazing to see something that almost seemed like an anti-television episode where this guy, you know, if you don't know the plot, this guy living in sort of a boarding house, he never married this woman who I think was obviously his girlfriend for years and they never got married. And he has his old radio, he plugs it in and it plays old radio shows, which I guess was a, you know, not a common thing in those days. And he's suddenly youthful again. He's like laughing and having a good time. And, you know, he's lecturing the others about how horrible TV is.
Oh my God. Yeah. He's like,
how horrible rock and roll music is. It's like all these things. It's like, gee, I'm actually relating to this guy. And, I mean, the show you need to see for yourself. I don't really want to give it away because, like, I don't think most people have actually seen this episode.
No, I'd never seen it before. It's pretty scarce.
But I think it was really touching. It really hit some emotional points. And I mean, you know, considering this is only like 25 minutes to tell this story, I just thought it just hit most of it. It just hit just right. And I'm thinking, well, if it was shot on film, it might have been a little better. But I mean, what's here is pretty impressive considering this is videotape and these actors are probably, you know, pressed to do maybe one or two takes of this stuff. And it just works. And also, because it's videotape, they can't really emphasize any post-production effects like some other episodes do.
No, that's right. And I'm actually staggered there was videotape around in 1960. I was really impressed with this one. Like I said, I'd never seen it. But and as soon as I watched it, Static, I wasn't too sure. I didn't read the synopsis or anything. I just put the episode in. As soon as it was about a guy with a radio, I'm like, yeah, this clicks with John because you're, as you said, a massive fan of old-time radio.
Yeah. And like I said, I was just stunned. There was already nostalgia in the 50s for this stuff.
Well, Tommy Dorsey would have been the classic rock of 1960, I guess.
Yeah, you would have been like Led Zeppelin or Allman Brothers.
Yeah, or today's like Pearl Jam, probably.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Practically Godsmack, you know.
Oh, God. Please don't put the great Tommy Dorsey with that shit band. It's just blasphemous.
I actually downloaded some Tommy Dorsey just because of this episode. So
I actually have a I went through my records the few that I still have left in the garage in my crate about probably a couple of months back, and I completely forgot I had a six or seven disc box set of just old jazz legends, you know, Tommy Dorsey and Count Basie and his orchestra, and just I forgot I had it, and I think it was something I paid like maybe $20 for back in 1994 or something like that. Yeah, so kind of wish I had a turntable now. It's like, shit, I wouldn't mind listening to all this sort of stuff because I love that stuff, you know?
A friend of mine actually buys vinyl, does not have a turntable, and yet he collects vinyl, which kind of shows you that that's the vinyl collecting thing these days.
I don't get it. Why would you not have a turntable at least?
I think in his case he thinks, oh, okay, I'm going to get a turntable one day and it's going to be the best turntable you can get, you know, like he's saving up for it. I'm not sure what his strategy is, but I've got a Sony turntable that I bought like 20 years ago when you could get them for like $50. You could get a really top-notch one because records were not thought to come back. It was just a retro machine.
Yeah.
And bought it and it still plays, sounds great. There's a store in town that sells the needles, so I'm fine. But yeah, a lot of people buy those Crosley standalone things that look like old time radio machines or turntables, and
they look great. I love them.
Are they good quality? Or have you actually heard them? Or
I did.
I love their look. I totally agree with that.
Well, I did buy literally one that was from the '70s, back in the '90s, and that sucker was pretty heavy duty. Like it was solidly built. It wasn't flimsy. Like, you know the ones you see in department stores these days where, you know, you can play a record and burn it directly to MP3? I hate those units. I hate them.
Right.
So I would rather actually lash out when I do eventually buy a turntable because I want to hook it up to my theater room where all the high-end audio gear is.
Right.
I'd rather lash out a few $100 and get one. But then again, I'm worried about, well, I've got all this high-end shit. And this high-end turntable, well, am I going to have to start buying vinyl again? And, you know, the stuff you could buy, John, for $2, like, you know, the first Boston LP, now you're paying literally like about 10 times as much for the same quality one they had in the stores back then. It's because now vinyl's become such a buyer's market and a niche market that it's like, well, let's take, you know, Ted Nugent's Free For All, $4. We'll mark it up now to $15.
I know, it's crazy, and it's legit because I was in a grocery store, teenagers, you know, working the register and the bags, and they're talking about spending their checks on vinyl. And I was like, I must be hallucinating this.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think anybody would care. I thought it was just like a marketing ploy. Like, I'm reading these articles, the comeback of vinyl, and I'm like, oh, bullshit.
Well,
that's not happening.
Well,
you know?
Look at Hannah's place when I was staying there. Hannah's got a ton of vinyl.
Like, he's always posting his photos. Oh, look, I bought Hawkwind. I was like, what? It's like, this is crazy.
Well, he's got the half price books near him. He's got a few record stores as well, so he's pretty well set over there in Dallas with, you know, availability of stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it's insane in Dallas too.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. But yeah. So anyway, getting back to Static. Yeah, I really enjoy this one quite a bit. I didn't pick the ending of this one, which is always the, you know, a lot of fun to do with Twilight Zone episodes. Can you pick the ending? And I want to get into something about these episodes compared to something else just a bit later on that got me thinking yesterday. But yeah, fully enjoyed this one. I thought it was well acted as well.
Yes.
Really well. I couldn't work out first if they were actually in an old people's home because one of the guys in there looks middle-aged. So I'm like, a bit young to be in an old people's home.
I had trouble with it at first, and I realized it was sort of a boarding apartment house, and maybe those existed a lot in cities in the 50s.
Yeah, they probably did.
That was my guess, is there must have been a lot of establishments like that.
But that was one big-ass radio that guy had. He was like, you know, telling the young boy to lift up the stairs. And then did he say to him, I can't remember if he said this, when Dean Jagger had the radio brought up to his room and the young boy finished helping him, did he give him $1 and say, go out and buy yourself a switchblade?
I think he did.
Because I was looking for subtitles, but there was none after I'd heard it. And I went in the back, I go, did you just give him $1 and go tell him to go buy a switchblade?
Like, yeah, it was almost like a diss. It was like him dissing him or something for liking rockabilly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It was hot. I kind of did a double take of that too. I didn't quite catch it, but I think that's what he meant. Was he was, you know, it was like, you hoodlum. You listen to hoodlum music or whatever. So I'm guessing back in those days, because this is a standard in almost every American city is you could always find a public radio station that's playing jazz or older music. And I guess maybe that just didn't exist in those markets back then.
But thankfully, you know, with old time radio now, and it just there's everything's at your fingertips, as you know, John, you know, with the old radio shows. And you know, if you want to collect episodes of the Tommy Dorsey, you know, hour or some shit, they're out there somehow. They're out there, which is incredible.
People preserved them because I think they put them on records or shellac records for military bases for them to air on their radios. That's what really saved a lot of this stuff, because you'll often hear at the end of a shadow, this is an armed forces radio presentation.
Oh yeah blue charcoal. We've spoken about that before.
But it's always the armed forces, a lot of them were tapes. Or they were put on reels and then they were sent to these radio stations and military bases. That's where a lot of stuff got saved.
I've got a couple of CDs of Groucho Marx's radio stuff that was put out by a label here called Raven Records. And a lot of that stuff's actually done while they're actually at military bases.
Oh, wow.
Recorded at for the GIs out there. And, because they have, like, you know, Groucho Marx and... Oh, who's the other guy? I forgot his name. I don't know. But they had Lucille Ball as well on one of the skits. And, yeah, as soon as she came out, like, all the GIs just losing their shit over Lucille Ball. And
well, she was hot before the TV show.
Oh, yeah. I don't dispute that at all. You know? Yeah.
She was pretty good looking. But there was also the, like, I listened to a lot of the Martin and Lewis radio shows. And they're doing sketches. And a lot of them are written by Norman Lear. Later went on to, you know, basically develop All in the Family and Sanford and Son and all those sitcoms in the 70s. And, and like, he was the main comedy writer on Martin and Lewis. And that stuff was quite funny. I never understood the appeal of Jerry Lewis. Didn't grow up on his movies or anything. And so this is really my first exposure to a lot of his humor other than The Nutty Professor.
I found Dean Martin transcended better on radio. Jerry Lewis transcended better on television, because he's definitely more visual than Dean Martin is.
Right. You can tell he's doing facial expressions that are cracking up.
Sure.
You cannot see it. I mean, Dino, he's great on radio because he's, you know, breaks out to a song and there's your musical segment and that's not going to suck.
But he's also good on TV as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic. That's, I'll tell you what, I've been itching to get those Dean Martin celebrity roast done.
They're worth it. They're worth getting. Only about three of them are great or really good, but I think the best one is the Johnny Carson roast.
Okay, I have not seen it. I've seen the Sammy Davis Jr. one. It's like, it was...
I don't know if I've watched that one yet. The Don Rickles one was disappointing, which had me thinking maybe they must have cut back on a lot of offensive material or something.
Yeah, I mean, they're not as risque as the ones done by Comedy Central in the 2000s.
No, they couldn't get away with as much because they were on NBC. They were like aired during the family hour, because I remember when they were still airing and it was like at 6 p.m. on Sundays.
Yeah.
They were running up against 60 Minutes on CBS, which nobody could beat in the ratings. So there was like, okay, just throw Dean Martin celebrity roast there. But the Johnny Carson one was absolutely a riot. I mean, there was a lot of jokes you could not do today. They wouldn't even do on Comedy Central. They're very, very race oriented.
Oh, yeah. Like with the Sammy Davis one, I think there was a thing where someone said, "Is Sammy out there? Smile. I can't see you." And it's like, yeah. And even actually, John, I've got the Rat Pack Live at the Sands on CD. I picked up for like $1. Like,
yeah.
And that was one of the ones I think I always wanted to get. They had a DVD A of it, like DVD audio, where it was, you know, spread out and it was all the surrounds and felt like you were actually at the Sands. And but I just found the normal CD of it. And holy shit, some of the things that Dean Martin says in there, just in general, like race-related jokes, I'm sitting there, it misses me going, did he just say that? Really?
Well, there was always that standard joke that they did for years where Frank Sinatra would pick up Sammy Davis Jr. and go, I want to thank the NAACP for this award.
And the great thing was, like, Sammy would laugh about it.
You know, he had a sense of humor. People had thick skin back then. You know, words didn't hurt back then. It's like people didn't give a damn. It's like they were just they were jokes. Because they would also, Sammy was allowed to crack jokes about Frank being in the mob or being Italian.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Same thing with Dino and all those guys. They crack jokes on each other. It's like, in the jokes about Italians you could get away with today without protest. It's you know, it was very even-handed insult swinging back and forth. It wasn't one-sided like they were all picking on Sammy.
No,
some revisionist historians have tried to make it like that, and it's like, you watch the videos or you listen to it. It's like, that's not what's going on. It's totally even-handed, you know, ball-busting from both sides or all three or four, you know. It's just like, it's such – everybody's always trying to put today's values and perspectives on stuff that was like 50 years ago, which is like the silliest indulgence I've ever heard.
Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous is what it is. But you know what? Watching this episode of Static made me think that, you know what? Sometimes I really wish there was just a bit of a simpler life.
Yeah.
You know?
Just, I do too.
Yeah. Like, okay. What got me thinking was, yes, I'd like to have the internet, but I could fucking do without social media. John, I'd say internet. I would like to have the simplicity of the internet as it was back in, say, 99, but with the accessibility of speeds and stuff today.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, I'm not a big fan of Facebook. I'm on it too much, like, because I could work and be on Facebook at the same time.
Really? Yeah,
it's a terrible temptation.
I've scaled it back. So I'm like, I'm barely there. If you look at me with posts, I'm like, there'll be posts 3 days ago, and I don't care, you know.
I'm probably going to have to start scaling back big time. Although I've been able to grab some of our guests through Facebook contacts.
So. Yeah, sure.
You know, but I'm just kind of, I'm tired. It's like, it's too overwhelming. Too many people are on there not thinking about what they're posting at all. And there's too many rumors repeated, and I'm seeing these urban legends post, you know, blogs spreading hoaxes. It's getting me such a waste of time. And it's smart people posting this stuff who should know better. It's just because they just don't read the links. They're just thinking impulsively, and boom, there it is, you know?
Same with that, you know, here's a steak I cooked, and here's, I mean, okay, I'm guilty. Yeah. I've done it before. I've done, you know, burritos the size of Melbourne. But, you know, these days I'm like, That's my business, you know. Right. I might put up, I picked up these films. I might see how I feel, but I'm not really, you know, it's more like you're just gloating about the fact that you've got this and you guys don't. And
I don't get the foodie thing at all with the taking photos about what you're about to eat. It's like, I just don't understand that. I don't remember what I eat from day to day. I'm just like, this is just fuel for me to run, you know, or go lift weights or you know,
be a... Yeah, but I mean, just, you know, and also like some of the barbecue groups I'm with, someone's like, oh man, I got up at 5:30 in the morning, about to cook some beef short ribs. I mean, I don't care. I mean, I really don't care. You've rubbed them in fucking pepper
everybody,
and salt.
Everybody wants to be Guy Fieri.
they really do, you know, or, you know, Myron Mixon's like, man.
Slow roasted sausages straight from Louisiana, you know.
Yeah, just crazy. But, yeah, like Static, you know, just got me thinking about just the more simpler parts of life. You know, there's many a times I'll just sit down in the garage if I'm doing some work in it, you know, they're clearing up my mess, and just, I'm quite happy to have the radio on, you know, AM radio. I detest FM radio. I hate the fake jokes. I hate the fake everything. I hate the music. I'm a talkback sort of person. I love talkback radio.
I was listening to Mike Rowe talk about, he said the worst place to be interviewed was Australia, because on every show he would go on, they'd all ask the same question. They go, all right, Mike, what's your dirtiest job?
Yeah. And they always do the, what do you think of Australia? It's like, what do you think you're going to say? It's a pile of shit. It's no. I hate watching TV interviews like that. I switch off. It's the same cookie cutter, you know, regurgitated questions. I've heard them all before. There's nothing probing. There's nothing interesting. So
there's no talk shows I watch like whatsoever. Might watch a little bit of Charlie Rose if he's talking to somebody I'm interested in, but I won't like cold watch it. You know, watch it regardless of who's on it or whatever. No, so it's like, that's it. It's just, I can't stand any of that stuff. No. I hate all these fake Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon.
No, they're just rehearsed. I mean, everything's so rehearsed. Everything's
scripted, bad sketches. Like, the humor is like some sort of youth appeal humor I don't get. Like, I'm just out of
generous. It's just like,
oh god,
it's all pretty. It's like, the things that piss me off the most when they do this thing that's, you know, supposedly spur of the moment, and the host like Ellen or Jimmy Fallon will go, oh, I had no idea I was being dragged into this bullshit. Come on.
And if you watch like the 60s Carson tapes that survived, they're getting drunk. they're getting smashed.
Yeah.
A boozed up, like, Robert Wagner will just suddenly walk on stage unannounced and join the talk and stuff. It's like crazy stuff. It looks like when I watched SCTV and they had the Sammy Maudlin show, they would have that type of stuff. I didn't know they were making fun of the Real Carson shows from the 60s. Yeah. Like, that's the way they were. It's like they were just coming, you know, Frank Sinatra come out and make mob jokes and threaten to beat everybody up, you know. Yeah. And everybody's drunk and smoking cigarettes, so just puffing away.
I watched an interview with that guy had inside the actor's studio. I forgot his name.
James Lipton.
Lipton, that's it. Yeah. And right. The best interview I saw with him ever was the one he did with Sir Ian McKellen.
Mm-hmm.
And he just sat down and was honest. And McKellen sat there with a bottle of red wine and a glass. And the James Lipton or Lupton said, "Why do you have that?" He goes, "Because I enjoy red wine. I'd like to have a glass while I'm being interviewed." Which I thought, that's pretty honest. I appreciate that.
It seems to me that's what I remember, like, interviews on PBS in the 70s. Like, even on William F. Buckley's Firing Line,
yeah.
It seemed like it was more like that. Like, the guest was just comfortable drinking wine, whatever the hell. You know, just there's some firing lines with Jack Kerouac on there. People don't even realize Jack Kerouac was really conservative, and he's trying to ham up like it's Carson. It's strange to watch.
But he wrote On the Road, man.
Yeah,
he's Jack Kerouac.
Dharma bums, you know. Yeah.
All right. So anyway, look, let's rate this episode of Static. What did you think of it? What would you give it out of 10?
Out of the Twilight Zones of that scale, I would probably give it a 7.
Yeah, I'll give it a... Yeah, 7 sounds right. That's perfectly fine. It's above average.
Yes.
It's way above average for television shows these days, that's for damn sure.
Oh, no, you need 5 seasons of continuity to tell one story.
God. Don't get me started. Like I said, I got something that I want to bring up very, very soon.
All right.
Okay. So, anyway, now we're going to get into the second episode of The Twilight Zone that we're going to be covering. And it is from season 1, episode number 6. So very, very early on in the Twilight Zone series. One called Escape Clause. First aired November 6, 1959.
Yeah.
And this is the one that I picked. And I picked it because I'd never seen it before up until a couple of years ago. And was just taken aback by the... I kept guessing what was going on with this guy up until the very end. So when it came time to pick an episode, I picked this one. Now, this is about a hypochondriac, a horrible, horrible human being played by David Wayne, named Walter Bedecker.
Yes.
Who is a self-absorbed hypochondriac, married to this lovely woman who he just treats like crap. And... at the start, he's got a doctor there with him who's saying that he's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with him. He's, you know, all these things are right with him. He's going, well, I'm going to die and you can come back in 20 minutes with a death certificate and blah, blah, blah. Basically, like a lot of people today, you know, just self-absorbed idiots who only worry about themselves. Now, when Bedecker's by himself, he's met with a man named, or a figure appears in his room who's named Ted Cadwallader. Ted Cadwallader, who offers him a deal, and basically Ted Cadwallader, that's a hard name to say, is the devil. Yep. Yeah. Walter Bedecker works out he's the devil. And in exchange for his soul, the devil will give him immortality. So he'll basically live as long as he wants. And he can never be killed, so... Walter Bedecker, the David Wayne character. I didn't realize it was David Wayne until the end credits. For those of you who don't know of David Wayne, no, it's not the singer from Metal Church who died a number of years ago. It's another David Wayne, the actor. It's the one who played the Mad Hatter in the Batman television series from series one, I believe he was. So, did forgot it was him. Anyway, Walter Bedecker decides to go out and... try and kill himself in a various number of fashions to see if his immortality is true. He jumps in front of a train, much to the disbelief and the shock of the people on the platform. He's not killed. He then starts claiming insurance for all these accidents, and he's just got like a line of insurance guys at his door just coming in, like literally a revolving door of insurance men coming in to give him a a check for $1,000, $1,500 for his accident in front of a bus and a train. And he starts getting bored with this whole death dealing or this death defying stunts that he pulls to see if he can actually be killed. So he decides to drink some, ammonia?
Yeah.
Yeah. His wife is like, "What are you doing?" And she hasn't worked out yet that he sold his soul to the devil. And he's bored, and he goes, he's going to jump off the top of the building. They live in a high-rise building. So his wife follows him up, trying to stop him, and she accidentally slips to her death. And the thing that struck me about this was, it was no sort of remorse or guilt. He just goes, "Oh, I wonder what that felt like." It's like, wow, this guy's a real bastard. Seriously, he just doesn't care at all.
Yeah, it was loaded with dark humor.
Oh, totally. Totally.
In many ways, it might have been the darkest episode I've seen since I started watching these again. I was really surprised. It's like, I don't even know if in today's television if they'd allow him to kill his wife like that.
No. And especially be as cold about it as well.
Yeah, he's cold and nonchalant. I mean, he was like, he went from being a really unsympathetic person to an outright just bastard. And it was surprising to see such an unlikable character as the center of attention. And these anthology shows, usually it's a sympathetic character in a terrible situation.
Usually.
In this case, it's a guy who, it's a horrible person who's been given great powers. And he's such a selfish prick. He's just does everything out of his own boredom. He's not trying to help people with this ability. He's basically got the powers of a superhero, and he's not doing anything except, boring himself. Amusing himself with his bullshit. So it's an interesting inverse of all the stuff we've seen in superhero movies over the past few decades.
So, but anyway, Baedeker is then he actually calls the police on himself to arrest him because he figures he's going to get the electric chair. He's going to get the death penalty, and he wants to see. He goes, "Oh, I wonder what the electric chair is going to be like." But, of course, the old great Twilight Zone twist, which we won't give away here, comes into effect. So that's all we're saying up. But what did you – have you ever seen this one before, John?
I've never seen it before. I swear it's probably been ripped off what seems like dozens of times in those 50s horror comics.
Probably.
I swear I've seen similar stories. Like, it's just in the same twist and everything. And it seemed like a very common traditional story, even though it's written by Serling. And probably, I'm sure the horror comics were ripping it off left and right. I don't think those are the most original publications out there.
Yeah, this has got Rod Serling all over it with his script.
Right.
His dark humor and his plot turns and everything are all in there. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I just think the humor is devilish. Pardon the pun. There's devilish humor in it. Yeah, it's certainly one of the ones I think you should check out. I mean, along with all the Twilight Zone. If you see the Twilight Zone out there, just buy it. Don't stream it. Just buy it. Because I've never heard of one person say, don't like that show much, or it's dated, or it doesn't hold up anymore. I've never heard of one person say that. Alfred Hitchcock Presents, I've heard some people say it. I've even thought about a couple of episodes myself. Are like, not so great. But, I mean, there's very, very few Twilight Zone episodes. I'm thinking to myself, gee, I didn't like that one.
There's a few that had technical problems. The final episode they aired with the swimming pool with the little kids swimming to a different world to avoid their dysfunctional parents. And it actually has kind of a dark ending. June Foray dubbed the voice of the little girl, and it's way too obvious because she sounds like Rocket J. Squirrel. They didn't have time to get the actress to come back and just loop her own voice, so she sounds like Rocket J. Squirrel throughout the whole episode.
I tell you what, you talk about a show that was anarchic for its time. Fucking Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Oh, yeah.
More than people know.
Most people don't realize it, and it's just like, no, if you go back and watch it, like, there were so many hidden jokes and double meanings and just everything. It's like it was way like they knew, okay, we've got cheap, terrible animation from Mexico.
Yep.
Let's do what we can. Let's make the most of it. And the writers on Rocky and Bullwinkle, I think, later went on to write for Get Smart.
So what would you give this one, John?
I'd probably give it probably about a 6.5. Like, and it's probably just because it's lacking any sympathetic human element. It's basically a dark comedy.
Yeah.
And the ending I've seen before. Like, I knew the ending was coming, because I'm just so familiar with horror short story cliches and stuff. I've read so many of these damn things. Yeah. But, you know, I was a kid who was seriously hooked on this stuff at one point. And but I really enjoyed it. I think the acting is good. It's totally worth watching. Don't skip this one. It's interesting, like I said, to see that it's the opposite of what you usually see on this show with sympathetic, you know, some almost heroic characters in bad situations. And here it's just an absolute bastard, you know, gets the power and what happens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, completely. But I myself will give this one only about an 8.5. So, yeah, that's basically it. Now, I got a small gripe of something that I was thinking about, just brief. Uh-huh. Well, we're talking about the Twilight Zone, and I was thinking about if this could be done again. Okay, yeah, I know it was done in the 80s and not very well either. It was right. Not so good, that 80s Twilight Zone. Do you think they could do an anthology show like this now and be as smart as well? No.
I don't think I've yet to see any writers, young writers, even middle-aged writers with that ability and that kind of stretch of imagination. And also the filmmakers and stuff who can do this by atmosphere, which is what it is. I mean, it sets up atmosphere and the pacing and the tension. It's like now it's hard to say what's really gone wrong with a lot of that type of entertainment. I'm hearing good things about Dark Mirror. I guess it's on Netflix. It's some sort of adult science fiction anthology thing.
Right.
But it's also where the genre... Okay, put it this way. Twilight Zone addresses a lot of things that are no longer an issue in our world today. Like the whole thing with the old-time... You know, static you couldn't do today. It would make no sense today.
No.
Because we can just press a button, we hear whatever we want to listen to. So it doesn't... You know, you can get your own... entertainment because of the internet. I think actually the internet's actually killed the chances of anything like this being made. It's because we used to have a kind of a shared culture. Everybody watched the same sporting events. Everybody watched The Wizard of Oz, you know, on TV every year. Sure. When CBS would air it in America. Maybe in Australia, you've probably got similar TV events. Everybody watched The Ten Commandments on Easter weekend.
Mad Max 2.
Right. It's always a tradition, and everybody used to do it. Everybody would talk about it at school or at work the next week or whatever, or next day. Yeah. We don't really have that shared culture anymore because the internet allows people to go into their own diverse interests. And if I feel like looking into, you know, Cantonese comedies from Hong Kong of the 80s, I can just do it at the press of a button and watch one on YouTube. I can watch Chicken and Duck Talk.
Yeah.
That didn't exist back then. Every life moved at that simple pace that kind of, you know, you could have these stories that were about the possibilities of technology. And the problem is those have come and gone. Like Steel, the episode with the robot boxer. Well, they had those competitions in like the 90s where the robots fought each other and shot flamethrowers and attacked each other with claws. And
shit.
I forget what they call it. It never really took off, but it was something like Anarchist Labs or something like that. These guys invented these crazy automaton things that would shoot flamethrowers, and I'm sure somebody could probably tell us what it will, you know, email what this was, but they were like shoot flamethrowers at each other, attack each other with battering rams and stuff. It's beyond anything they could come up with at CBS in the 50s.
It sounds like an Enzo G. Castellari movie.
Right. It looked like Enzo G. Castellari. All you need was Fred Williamson, you know, on the mic of thing, you know,
Mark Gregory.
These robots are devastating, you know. Yeah. It's just like nothing, or it's like some Japanese cartoon brought to life. I mean, it's literally that crazy now. And now the idea of science fiction and movies are these really kind of dumb superhero films that, and I'm not putting them down because I enjoy some of them, but they're not really smart. You know, people think they're smart. They're just rehashing James Bond cliches in superhero costumes is all they're doing. And we think they're smart because they're sort of like Bond movies. But that whole science fiction imagination thing, I think, is at a low point right now.
Because what got me thinking was that I liked M. Night Shyamalan's first sort of body of work. But what I thought about was if you had taken Unbreakable, Signs, mm-hmm. and The Village,
right,
they really didn't need to be full-length features. You could have cut them down to a half-hour trim story each one and made it an anthology.
True.
And that's where they failed. Like, okay, now Unbreakable didn't fail. Very, very popular. Massive hit when it came out. Signs, I like Signs, but it goes on and on and on. And really the high point of that is, you know, that part with the kids where the, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is watching the TV and he sees those kids in Venezuela or Mexico or something. I see that alien in the backyard. That is fucking creepy.
That was terrific. That was like the
fantastic.
Best.
Fantastic. I mean, and that could have been really trimmed down to 30 minutes again with Unbreakable. Yep. Again with, I mean, the village, if you had to count it to a half hour, like I've been saying, it could have been a really decent half hour.
I never saw The Village. That was where I stopped with Signs because I just thought it was okay.
Yeah.
Like, it had some high points, but it was just ended up being Night of the Living Dead with aliens instead of zombies. And I was just kind of done. And then I kept hearing so many bad things about The Village. I never watched another Shyamalan movie ever again. I know he had the one with the plants attacking people and.
Oh, the happening. The happening.
Yeah, just didn't interest me. It's like nothing. And then he, you know, then he does like a. The kung fu movie, The Last Airbender, or whatever, with all white kids playing roles that are clearly Chinese in the cartoon or Indian. Yeah, it's just like there's nothing there with that guy. I was like, okay, he's done. Like he has that obsession with that Richard Matheson type twist that he likes to do in the you know the end of the film, and then that's it.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, we got the Masters of Horror series that came out, like, you know, John Carpenter did one, and
yeah.
A bunch of others. I forgot. Was it Mick Garris was another one who did one.
John Landis, Stuart Gordon.
That's it. That whole series.
Joe Dante. I thought that was really bad stuff for all these directors that brag to us. Oh yeah, man, you take the handcuffs off, and I don't have to deal with the MPAA. I'll show you some real horror, and then they just do this kind of lame shit.
Yeah,
and I didn't get it. I was just like, and I watched most of them, and none of them really stood out. Even by directors I like Carpenter and Don Coscarelli, I was just never really impressed with them. They were just like, they were either too negative or they were too in love with the idea of being gory as hell and trying to be as offensive as possible. And Joe Dante did a really political one, which I just thought was dumb. And I said, boy, is this going to look stupid in a few years? And it looked stupid the week it aired. You know, it was just like, just dumb crap.
Well, I found the one film that did it right with anthologies, like trim 25-minute, 30 stories, was Creepshow.
Yeah.
Creepshow was really. It still really holds up quite well. Creepshow 2, not as much. And they even stole the story from Twilight Zone for Creepshow 2 with the hitchhiker.
Yeah, sure did. Well, also the Twilight Zone movie, which I think is a pretty bad film, even if it hadn't killed Vic Morrow.
It's just think, look, now, is that your real beef with the film that actually Vic Morrow got killed and you hate John Landis?
No, when I saw it as a kid, I thought, okay, this is really loud, it's not boring, but there's something missing. And I couldn't comprehend when I was 12 what was wrong with the movie. And then I thought about it more when I started watching these episodes a few months ago, or really just last month with my son, is I said, oh, because they relied on loudness, bright spinning colors, and you know, heavy special effects. And I like the George Miller segment. I loved it.
It's when very
I was
good. Yeah.
I thought that was the only reason to watch it was that. I thought the Joe Dante one.
A lot of people say that about the George Miller segment. It's the best one to watch.
Right. I thought the Joe Dante one was exhausting and draining and didn't really go anywhere compared to the original segment, which was really memorable. It's like, you know, you compare those and that's what's wrong with it. Is it's loud. My biggest beef with horror movies today, they're filmed like action movies. Well, that was filmed like Raiders of the Lost Ark or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, and that's not how you do the Twilight Zone. The Twilight Zone is mood and tension. And here that movie was just machine gun paced and throwing things in your face and really aggressive and loud. I saw it on like a 70mm screen with like crazy 8-track stereo.
Oh,
and
wow.
Stuff.
Yeah, that would have been loud as hell.
It was down in New Orleans. It was just, it was quite an event, but it's like there wasn't much to remember about the movie as being good. And, you know, the TV show did it better.
Yeah, well,
the emphasis is on script, you know what I mean?
The TV show, the attitude there is less is more.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't need a massively loud sound design. It doesn't need crazy special effects. They're basically like stage plays.
Yes, they are. A lot of them are.
And, you know, still very effective, more effective than the film. I like the film. I think the two best segments are without doubt the first one with Vic Morrow and the last one with John Lithgow.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the Vic Morrow one because that's, I think that was a new story. It had never been done before.
Yeah, it was original for that. But my thing was like, was John Landis saying like the Viet Cong were the good guys? and the Americans were the bad guys in Vietnam. Because it's like,
It was. I mean, it was very
typical douchiness of him, and ironic considering he killed two Vietnamese kids in the filming of that segment. And it never ended because they never finished it. It's like it was missing like two scenes or something that they never got around to doing, thanks to cocaine and Landis's bad decisions. But it just never completed. It was a good idea, but it just never finished.
Yeah. But I mean, I like it. I mean, I own it, and I'll pop it on from time to time. And I mean, I have cranked it up loud, and you know, in the home theater up here, I've watched it once before, and it is loud, especially when you see that part with who's the stars? Dan Aykroyd and Steve Guttenberg driving as the ambulance driver.
I thought it wasn't it Albert Brooks?
Albert Brooks. My bad. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I think it was. I haven't seen it in decades. And
Albert Brooks and Dan Aykroyd, and when you want to see something scary, he turns around, he's got that zombie mask. Holy shit! That is loud.
That was really effective in the theater. I remember the whole crowd jumped when he turned around with the mask on.
that was good. But I like the Twilight Zone. Yeah, definitely less is more with these things. And 50 something years, nearly 60 years since the first one.
Well, what's interesting to note is that in the 70s, Rod Serling was trying to develop a Twilight Zone movie, and his idea was to expand that episode, A Good Life, the Billy Mummy superpowered one, as a full length feature instead of doing anthologies or whatever. So I don't know how it would have worked. I mean, he was a skilled screenwriter. He would know better than anybody, but the movie never got off the ground.
Well, he wrote the original Planet, well, he adapted the original Planet of the Apes film. So,
you know, it's really his Planet of the Apes because it's so different from the book.
And
Yeah, it's different. And like in the book, it's like they live in like modern ape cities.
Yeah, like the animated series from the 70s. That's more
right. It's closer to that.
Yeah, it is. It's more in line with the Pierre Boulle novel. All right, brother. I think we better call it a day. We've read along quite a bit about everything and anything. So, yeah. Rock Month coming up soon, mate. Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah.
This our most popular and most unpopular month of programs. Probably.
Yeah, depending on who you are. Yes, it's like, yeah, okay, see you guys in July or something like, yeah, I can't wait to see what you got for June. Sorry about that. Until we get this music podcast up and running, we work out what the hell we're doing on that. So we've got to still persevere with Rock Month. And we've got our final pick, our collective pick worked out. As for the solo ones, that's our problem. We'll sort it out. But you got any ideas in yours, John, that you won't divulge until after we're finished?
I'm sure we'll do Asia, Third Eye Blind, Toto.
Well, Hunter and I were saying that we were really pushing to do Twisted Sister.
Oh yeah, I'll skip that one. Yeah. I can't listen to those guys. I'm sorry.
I said to Hunter last week, let's just tell John we're going to do Twisted Sister. He'll be like, no, I'm not doing it. He'll go.
Yeah, I can't read Garfield comic strips for the show either. So,
D. Snyder, poor bastard. All right. All right, brother, let's call it a night, and we'll be back next week with something or another. And hopefully we'll have Hunter back next week. So until then, I'll say adios.
And I'll say mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? visit midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
FTV.